Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news recap from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. On the program today, the BYU Police Department faces decertification for failing to investigate alleged misconduct by one of its officers. Also, Representative Ben McAdams votes against President Trump's border emergency. A state tax reform plan emerges. And a proposal to prevent cities from banning plastic bags advances at the state legislature. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. Welcome, Dan.
Good morning.
Reporter Jessica Miller is here as well. And thank you for being here, Jessica.
Hello.
And on the phone from Washington, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. And welcome to you, Tommy.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255, or you can post your questions at sltrib.com. You can also tweet us at KCPW, and we will check your questions there. To begin with, we've got Thomas Burr for just the first 15 minutes, and so we will start with you, Tommy. Ben McAdams in a couple of votes.
Nothing going on in Washington at all, so yeah.
Right, right. There's nothing happening there. Nothing's been happening this past week.
Nothing at all.
I want to talk, though, about Representative Ben McAdams. And in a couple of votes that happened this week, he sort of showed that he was a Democrat. He was the lone Utah yes vote for a couple of measures. And maybe let's start with guns, since there's a second story there as well having to do with a vote that he had. But first off, a bill to expand background checks for all gun purchases. Thomas Burr, what happened there?
Yeah, so this is interesting. And this is kind of gives us a light into, you know, maybe what Ben McAdams is going to be like as a congressman, because, you know, he's brand new. And he's a Democrat, but he, you know, represents a, you know, more conservative district. So this was kind of a test this week to see where he would fall. Is he going to be in the, you know, Jim Matheson fold, or is he going to be more liberal or more conservative? The vote was to expand background checks for any gun purchases. So, like, Roger, I want to sell you a gun. I would have to register with the federal government and, you know, go through the background check and everything. So that was essentially the measure, and Ben McAdams voted for it. He says he supports the Second Amendment, but he wants to make sure that, you know, that we go through these things and people cannot just, like, you know, go to a gun show, buy a gun without ever going through any kind of FBI check. So he supported that measure. All of Utah's other Republican members voted against it.
Democrats say that expanded background checks are a way to stop people who are, you know, intent on doing harm or on committing a crime from getting hold of a gun. This is background checks, again, for all gun sales or transfers. That includes private purchases. And these are gun sales where background checks aren't currently required. These are, you know, sort of referred to as places where there are loopholes, I guess, right?
Yeah, Democrats argue that's a major loophole for the Democrats, say, because, you know, I can give a gun to my neighbor or sell a gun to my neighbor, but there's no check, and who knows who that guy is. He's a felon, or, you know, he has, you know, harm, and he intends harm on somebody. So they say this is a, you know, major loophole that has led to, you know, shootings, people killing other people because they shouldn't have had a gun in the first place. And, you know, there's obviously counter arguments to that point. But Democrats are pointing out, you know, there are thousands of deaths that happen because, you know, a lot of those suicides because people shouldn't have guns in the first place.
And, so part of this is showing, you know, when McAdams is voting the way he is, that, look, who you elect for a given district makes a difference in what votes will be cast. Then there's the sort of political scrutiny that comes with any vote, especially when you're, you know, the outlier compared to the other, you know, the rest of the delegation in Washington. Is there a political fallout? Is Ben McAdams facing criticism for this vote, Tommy?
So I'm sure he is, but, you know, and I think we've seen polling in the past that shows that, you know, while Utahns absolutely support the Second Amendment, they also see reasonable regulations on the Second Amendment. And I think that goes to what we're going to get into next, and I'll just go for it.
Right. Go ahead, jump right in.
kind of the split the baby moment that Ben McAdams had this week, where the congressman voted to expand background checks for all purchases and transfers of guns, but then the next day, yesterday, he voted against a bill that was essentially going to say the background checks right now, if I want to go buy a firearm, I go through background check. The FBI has 3 days to do the background check. If they don't come back with it, or they, you know, come back favorably, then I can buy the gun on the fourth day. The Democrats' bill was to extend that to 10 days so that, you know, the FBI has more time. That's a pretty rushed process, the Democrats are arguing. And Ben voted against that. He says, you know, this is more, you know, added regulation that just hurts, you know, law-abiding citizens. So it is kind of, like I said, the split the baby moment. Is, you know, he wants more background checks, but not necessarily expanding the regulations around them.
Is it that, so right now, is it that the FBI can't conduct all these background checks in that three-day window, and so there are, you know, on that fourth day, a lot of people are getting guns by default?
Well, the Democrats would argue, and one of the main things they talked about is they called it the Charleston loophole, which is, we all remember Charleston, South Carolina, where Dylann Roof went in and shot up a historic black church and killed, nine people, I think. And he was a person who had applied for a gun, got a gun, but shouldn't have one. And because the FBI wasn't able to come back, they didn't find his past offenses, he was able to buy a gun because there wasn't enough time for them to actually do the background check to, you know, look at his criminal record. And so they're, you know, saying this is clearly a loophole. People died because they didn't have the time. Let's give them more time.
You know, I'm wondering, just going back to McAdams' vote, is it at all strange, and I don't know who to ask this question to, actually, to be in favor of increasing the number of background checks in one vote and then not extending the window in which the FBI has, you know, to get those background checks done in another vote? It seems like, I mean, you talked about this, the sort of disconnect there. Dan Harry, government and politics editor, do you want to jump in on this? Yeah.
Tommy and I discussed this a little bit yesterday, and we talked about, as he said, splitting the baby. I think what you're seeing in McAdams is very much what we saw in Jim Matheson. He's going to basically have to calculate every vote. I think that, as Tommy said, the universal background check is a fairly popular thing. And then he voted the next day against it. Again, you know, he's trying to come right up the middle of this very polarized issue, as is Congress polarized, and he's trying to come up the middle aisle. And so I think you're going to see a lot of these things where he is going to try to be sort of the moderate voice of reason, and I think that's what those two votes were about.
Tommy.
You know, it's going to be one of those difficult things I think McAdams is going to face in Congress, because Democrats control the House, Republicans control the Senate. Obviously, we have Trump in the White House. It's going to be a difficult spot for him to be in, and he's going to be forced in some of these very difficult votes on again and again and again, just because, you know, the Democrats want to push an agenda that maybe he's not really in line with, but it's also, you know, he's a Democrat, so we'll see.
Okay. Does he, though, specifically address the disconnect between the two votes that he made? I mean, did he talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are some logical arguments you can make to differentiate those two. And what he said was technology is to the point where, you know, it shouldn't be a problem to handle those within a three-day period. Most of it is, you know, done electronically and with you know, databases that are the speed of light. So, you know, there is argument for what he did.
Okay. Again, a reminder that we're speaking with reporters and editors from the Salt Lake Tribune, and you are invited to join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments. That's 801-355-TALK. Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief, you covered yet another piece of legislation where the vote from McAdams was different from that of his fellow Utahns, and that's this one had to do with the national emergency that the president, President Trump, declared on our southern border. How did McAdams vote there?
Yeah, so McAdams also supported the Democratic move here. Just to give a little background, so the president obviously lost his fight with Congress to try to get funding $5.7 billion for a border wall, and so after that kind of stinging rebuke, the president declared national emergency, and he's going to take funds from military construction, some other, you know, seized funds of the Treasury Department, and use that to build some kind of physical barrier at the border. And you know, Democrat-led House is not really having it, so they passed a resolution, and Ben McAdams supported it to say the president can't do that. You know, it was a pretty party line vote for the most part, and Ben McAdams' logic was, this is an overreach of executive power, that we shouldn't allow the president. It's a dangerous, you know, slippery slope kind of situation to go into, where you let the president just say something's a national emergency and take money from somewhere else that Congress didn't appropriate and put it towards something else. The other Republicans in Utah's delegation voted against the resolution, but they said, you know, that they didn't really, you know, like that the president did this, but they do believe there's something needs to be done at the border. So it was kind of a we don't like it, but we're going to live with it.
Dan Harry, government politics editor.
You know, you talked about the uncomfortable votes that Ben McAdams will face as a Democrat in the House. I think this was an uncomfortable vote for Republicans because, I mean, this has been one of the main themes of the Republican Party is executive overreach. And we've heard it again and again and again in returning power to Congress and the states. And yet here, the very Republicans from Utah that you've heard this message from countless times are not willing to stand up and say, no, that's federal overreach, because it's the president of their party. And so I've got to think that was somewhat uncomfortable for them.
Tom, go ahead.
Really uncomfortable, and I'm really fascinated to see how this is going to turn out. Because the House passed the resolution, the Senate now has to take it up. And I'm waiting and just with bated breath to see how Senator Lee and Senator Romney vote on this. Romney was very clear that he didn't think the president should do this. Senator Lee has been, you know, one of the leading voices of, you know, we got to live by the Constitution, and we, you know, the powers, you know, the Article 1 is the first article of the Constitution is about Congress, not the president, and the Constitution gives Congress the power to do things. So will Romney and Lee vote with Republicans, or will they say, you know what, we're going to stick by our tenets and vote, pass the resolution against it?
It's a real clear test of principle versus party.
Will the Senate definitely take this up?
Yeah,
okay.
They have to.
Okay.
Yeah, it's you know, because of the rules in Congress, because the House voted on it, it has to go to the Senate, and they have to vote on it.
And then
I should put a caveat there. You know, this town is crazy sometimes, so I don't know. Maybe there's some kind of rule that Mitch McConnell can find somewhere, but right. As far as I understand, they have to vote on it.
And then the president is likely to veto this. I mean, is going to veto this, correct, if it passes the Senate as well?
Yeah, and that would be the president's first veto, but I think he's ready and excited to actually do that because it would show his base that he's sticking with the wall.
Okay. Tommy, just before I know we have to let you go here in a minute, I want to get to one more story that you wrote. This was on the passage of a massive lands bill, a big conservation bill with implications for Utah public lands. What happened there?
You know, this was actually one of the first times in the last few years I've seen such amazing, overwhelming bipartisanship. So this is a public lands bill that it's really massive. It's the first one in decades to do so much for public lands. It adds a lot of new wilderness. You know, Republicans got some things as far as, you know, hunting and fishing and more recreation areas. It has a big implication for Utah in passing the Emery County Lands Bill, which, you know, adds a couple hundred thousand acres of wilderness in that area, but also, you know, there's some areas where people can now, you know, do recreation where they couldn't have before. But it really is a big deal, and it passed just overwhelmingly. It's one of those things that I wrote last week about how environmental groups were like cheering on Rob Bishop. Usually they hate him. This time around, they were really excited because Congressman Bishop was really leading the charge to get this passed in the House. It includes, you know, there's going to be a new Jurassic National Monument in Utah and some small land exchanges. But it's really just a sweeping public lands package that pretty much everyone liked.
Unusual bedfellows there. I mean, again, Republicans like Rob Bishop, Rob Bishop hasn't been considered a great ally of conservation organizations, or at least they themselves haven't considered him that. How is it that, I mean, this is just the right bill at the right time, I guess?
You know, I think it was one of those, again, unique times when actually Republicans and Democrats could sit down and say, like, okay, let's negotiate. Okay, you get some, I'll leave some on the table. And they actually worked it out. Maybe it's because everything else is so crazy going on, everyone else on other issues that maybe they could get together. But it was a give and take, and it was an actual compromise, which is what we should be doing here in Washington.
Dan Harry, any comments on this?
Yeah, there were a few notable exceptions to this kumbaya, and one of those was Senator Mike Lee from Utah, who originally tried to block the proposal altogether and then voted against it. And his position on this really drew some ire from other Utah political leaders and some back and forth. Lee called out the governor on this issue. And, it kind of made Mike Lee look like he's out of step, is what happened.
All right. Well, it's a story that's interesting and kumbaya, except for one senator. Thomas Burr, I know we need to let you go. We have to head to our first break of the show, but thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we will turn to the unprecedented pending decertification of the BYU Police Department. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cache Valley Cowboy Rendezvous, March 1st through 3rd at Mountain Crest High School in Hiram, including Stephanie Davis, heard on public radio, the High Country Cowboys, American Idol contestant Kristen Harris, Doris Daly, and Ned Ledoux. Information at cvcowboy.org.
Allegations that Michael Jackson sexually abused young boys have been around for years. A new documentary dives into the stories of two accusers and their families.
They were dazzled. They were starstruck. You know, they let their little boys sleep in Jackson's bed night after night and didn't think twice about that.
We hear from the director of the new documentary on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 3 to 6:30 with host Shalane Smith Needham.
Utah Public Radio would like to thank our partners, the Center for Persons with Disabilities, for sponsoring our news programming on Utah Public Radio. Find out how you can become a sponsor by emailing debbie.andrew@usu.edu.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry and reporter Jessica Miller. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or tweet us at KCPW. Jessica Miller, let's turn now to a story about the BYU Police Department. This is actually a story that you have been following, that the Salt Lake Tribune has been following for quite a while now. Mm. The story begins with one officer on the force and how he accessed information from state police agencies and then what he did with that information. I'm not certain how or where to dive into the story. Maybe with the pending decertification of the BYU Police Department that was announced earlier this week. Who decertifies a police force, and why is it happening?
So the Department of Public Safety is the state entity that kind of that gives the policing powers to an agency. And so this week they announced that they're basically going to decertify the Brigham Young University police force because for two reasons. One, they're saying that they did not do an internal investigation into this officer that was accused of misconduct. That's required of police departments if there's any sort of accusation. And then two, over the last few years, the Department of Public Safety has been investigating this record sharing issue. And as part of that, you know, they've been giving subpoenas and things like that to BYU police and to the university, trying to get certain records, trying to figure out with how the structure of the police department is set up. And according to DPS, you know, BYU hasn't adequately responded to those subpoenas. So they're saying, you know, if you're not going to give us these records, if you're not going to cooperate, then you cannot be a police force in Utah.
What maybe you can tell us now about then the story of actually, first, we should say that BYU the BYU Police Department is challenging that decision. What does a challenge look like for that?
So they're appealing that decision. How exactly that process works is a little bit unknown because this has never really happened before. But my understanding is there will be some sort of hearing, and I don't know exactly what that will entail. But they're basically saying that this is maybe like some sort of technicality. They obviously disagree with this decision. So they are planning to appeal that.
And again, this all stems from investigators finding that one police officer at Brigham Young University Police Force was accessing private police reports from other police agencies in the state, the Orem Police, Utah County Sheriff's Office, and Provo Police. And that's not unusual. That happens. But then he took that information from those reports and passed that information on to BYU's Honor Code Office, the Dean of Students, and others. He did that for a couple of years, right? For a couple of years, right?
Right. And the difficult thing with this is it's really hard to know the scope of what they found or what he had been doing because the records, the investigative records, you know, even records, I've tried to get records of, you know, logs of when this officer was logging in, looking at other agencies' files, and they've just been completely locked down because of this pending investigation. And now, you know, they still won't release the records, and they're not really saying why. So yesterday we received this document that for the first time just kind of gave this hint at the scope of what investigators found. And it was that, you know, that he had been accessing other agencies' reports that should have been private, was giving that information to university offices. But how frequently that was happening, it was, you know, in a 2-year period, how many times that was happening, it's kind of unclear still.
Why? I mean, maybe you can remind us what the Honor Code Office is at BYU and what it does, and then why they would want this information or why he would be passing this information on to them.
So the Honor Code Office, you know, it's basically the rules that the students have to follow to be student, you know, to be in good standing and to be in classes at BYU. They can't drink alcohol or coffee, you know, they can't have sexual contact with anyone if they're not married, you know, things like that. It's just rules that they have to follow. So the idea, and you know, we did find one case. I have seen records from one case specifically where someone from the Honor Code Office reached out to this lieutenant and said that they wanted to do an Honor Code investigation of a student who had reported being sexually assaulted. And they asked for some information about the case that was at Provo Police Department. And the lieutenant went into that file, got some of the information from that case specifically to give back to the Honor Code Office so that they could do an investigation to show whether the alleged victim had broken the Honor Code in any way.
So in that instance, it's that the Honor Code Office is asking for this information from Provo Police via the campus police department. I mean, from this particular individual saying,
right,
"Can you go and get this information for me?" Was that how it normally worked? Was he sharing that information at request, or was he doing it in other instances as well? Do we know?
That's what I would like to know. But like I said earlier, I mean, we have not been able to get any of these investigative documents yet. This is some, I think, you know, every couple of months for the last almost like 3 years, I'll try to figure out some other angle to try to like get at this in a different way. And it's just been really difficult to figure out the scope so far.
There's a guy you spoke with who has worked on campus safety issues for a long time, 30 years, in fact. And I just want to read his quote from your article. This is a quote that you got from S. Daniel Carter, who is the president of Safety Advisors for Educational Campuses, LLC. And he said, "It is common for institutions to use their campus police to also serve as security and enforce institutional policies. But use of police access to effectively spy on students to enforce non-criminal codes of conduct in this manner is unconscionable. In so doing here, a private entity would be using the power of the state to affect their own religious rules, something with potentially significant ramifications." I mean, we're talking about essentially the BYU police force in some instances serving as a private investigation service for the Honor Code Office at BYU, mm-hmm. and accessing police, you know, state records to do that. Is that right?
Right. And these are records that would not be public otherwise. I mean, this is access that they had because they are certified law enforcement agencies and they were given access to this database for law enforcement purposes. I would imagine at least in the case that I've seen, if the Honor Code Office had filed a records request with Provo Police seeking the documents that this officer read, they likely would not have gotten access to those. It was a pending case. The documents that he looked at were very sensitive. They would not have gotten that information if they would have just, you know, filed a records request like reporters do, or like anyone in the public could have done directly with agency.
I want to remind listeners to join this conversation, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And all of this, I mean, at least for the, from the Honor Code perspective, Honor Code Office's perspective is about enforcing those social norms, the rule of conduct on Brigham Young University's campus.
Right, the standards that the students have agreed to abide by.
You've mentioned, and maybe we still don't know how often BYU police was seeking information from other police departments in the states. Do we know what the searches they were doing were about? And again, we only have information about this one officer.
Yeah. And the only kind of hint that I've ever really gotten of this, besides what we were able to get yesterday, was we were able to get a database log a couple years ago that showed like this 18-month period and how frequently any BYU officer had been accessing any of the other Utah County agencies. It was like 6,500 times in an 18-month period. But that is just basically saying this person accessed a record. It didn't even say, it was redacted who even did it. So it's hard to say what officer was doing it and what purpose they had, because there are instances, obviously, when record sharing is very important interagency, especially, you know, if you're in the same county and if you're, you know, you've got a suspect who's, you know, doing breaking into cars or whatever in Orem, and then they're doing it in Provo, having that suspect information and be able to share that information can be really beneficial. So there are legitimate reasons why a BYU police officer would be looking at other agencies' records. It's just unclear when those were legitimate reasons, when they were at the request of university offices, kind of like what that did, exactly what was going on, pretty
much. It seems like that extra step, accessing the information to do the criminal investigation is one thing, then sharing that information is another thing. How unusual is it for a police department to be decertified? Did we address that earlier? I can't remember now.
I think DPS said that this is the first time that this has ever happened. So this is really unusual.
Dan Harry, government and politics editor, the unusual decertification of a police department at a university here in Utah, Brigham Young University. I don't know. This is a case. This is, to some extent, this is reporting that is continuing on reporting that the Tribune has done for a long time, and in fact, involving campus sexual assault and then how information is shared, that won the Tribune a Pulitzer. The story just keeps rolling.
It does keep rolling. And there's an interesting side note, too, which is that there's a bill in the legislature right now that would clearly designate a private school's police force as subject to the open records laws of the state. And as Jessica well knows, they fought that. The BYU fought that very, very fiercely for a long time. But now I guess they're saying, oh, it's okay. Yes, we acknowledge we're subject to grandma laws, right?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because the Tribune filed a lawsuit in 2016. We've had this pending lawsuit basically asking a judge to answer that question, like, is BYU police subject to public records laws? Because they've taken the position that they are not, that they're a private police force, part of a private university. The Tribune received a favorable ruling from a district court judge that said, yes, BYU police should be public. And then BYU appealed that decision to the Utah Supreme Court. So that question is still there at the Utah Supreme Court level. And in the court records, they're saying we're private. But then they're at committee hearings in the legislative session, they're saying we should be held to the same standard as everybody else.
Seems to have been a conversion here somewhere along the line.
But why? I mean, just to be more transparent, to show more transparency, is that the reason they're supporting this? But I guess I'm trying to figure out what brought that about.
I mean, I guess we can't speak to their motivations, but I would say that probably they think this legislation is going to pass, and they probably think they're going to lose again at the higher court. So, you know, maybe it's time to change your position.
Read the writing on the wall. Jessica, the police officer in question, the one police officer we know about who was accessing and sharing this information, what has become of him?
So he gave up his police certification, which is how we got these records yesterday, was this post, which is the agency that does the police certification for the officers. They were doing their own investigation into this specific officer, and if you give up your police certification, they stop the investigation. So he relinquished that certification. I talked with his attorney, or his attorney sent a statement yesterday that, you know, he'd always been planning to retire in October. And so he just decided, well, I'm retired now. There's no use in keeping this certification. So he just gave it up so that he wouldn't have to go. He already went through a criminal investigation. They didn't file charges against him in connection to this. So now to go through another investigation about his police certification, he just decided, I'm retired anyways.
And so that's...
he was just give up the certification.
What sort of things are we waiting for now? I mean, what is it that you, as the reporter who's been covering this for a while, are still waiting to find out? You've laid out some of that already, but and how might you find that out as well? Does that make sense? Records? You're waiting for records, obviously, but records about the police department. What's next in this story?
Well, so the Department of Public Safety did this investigation for like a year, and then the Attorney General's office had been reviewing it for another year. So for so long, my records requests were being denied because of this pending investigation or pending review. Now that's over. So in theory, we should be able to get all of these investigative documents that were created by the state agency looking into this department. But at this point, the Department of Public Safety has denied my requests and then said that they can't say why they're denying them because doing so would reveal private information. So I'm just appealing that decision to the State Records Committee. And so we'll see.
I don't think I've ever seen that as a reason to deny a records request that we can't tell you the reason we've denied it.
It's a little bit baffling. And it's hard, you know, when you do an appeal, you have to make an argument as to why you think these records are public. So it's really hard to make an argument when it's like
hidden.
What can you argue against? Say like, no, like you should have to tell me why. But yeah, so that's still pending with the State Records Committee. There's a hearing scheduled in a couple of months. And so I think that's kind of like the key is just figuring out the scope of this would be to get those records, to have that report released. And that just hasn't happened yet.
Again, this story stems from reporting on campus sexual assault and how it was handled, reporting that won Jessica Miller and your colleagues at the Salt Lake Tribune a Pulitzer Prize. We will keep following your reporting to see what you uncover, and thanks for that. I want to turn actually now away from that and into the state legislature, some developments that recently happened at the state legislative session, and Dan Harry, I don't know where to begin. Taxes, I guess.
Taxes. They're not a good place to start.
They're not necessarily the most fun to talk about, but there's an interesting tax package that we're starting to understand, a reform bill. This is reforming the tax system in Utah. Can we get the Crib Notes version of what's happening?
Well, you know, it's a pretty incredible plan that they're pushing right now. I don't recall in recent memory anything as ambitious as this. And what's happening is they're, you know, it's technical why they're doing this, but basically you have a couple of major funds in state government. One is education, which is funded by income tax, and one is the general fund, which pays for everything else from the Utah Highway Patrol to social services to the highway department, and that is funded by sales taxes. Well, as we all know, our economy has changed in recent years, and we're spending a lot more of our money on services than we are products. And if you think of your own life, you know, when you get to be my age, maybe you decide, I don't want to mow my lawn every week, so you hire a lawn care service to do it every other week. And right now, those lawn care services are not subject to sales tax. And many other things are not subject to sales tax. Legal services are not subject. Accounting services are not subject. Financial services are not subject to sales tax. If you buy property, a house or a commercial building, it's not subject to sales taxes. All of that would change under this plan.
Everything you just described.
Everything and more, much more. Haircuts, laundromats, vending machines, all of those now, newspapers, all of a sudden would be subject to sales taxes. So that's a huge change. That's a lot of oxes that are being gored. And the legislature, the leaders of the legislature had a fascinating meeting the other evening in the state office building where they gathered all of these lobbyists for all of the various industries that are having their oxes gored, and tried to walk them through it and answered some questions. And Brad Wilson, the House Speaker, acknowledged that as a developer and home builder, he, when he first saw this plan and the proposal to put a tax on the conveyance of real estate and many of the other contracted services that go into building homes and commercial development, plumbing and engineering and architecture and a lot of those services, he kind of went crazy on it. But then he said he sat back and started thinking of the larger picture, which is that our economy is changing. The taxable things that people are buying that they can be taxed on sales tax is shrinking. And we're getting to the point where we've been having to transfer money out of the education fund to supplement other services, highways, for instance. Mm-hmm. And that they want that to end. Looking into the future, they think that the sales tax revenue we're drawing under the current system is going to be smaller and smaller. And so they're trying to fix a problem that they think will head off kind of budgetary disaster in the future. But in the process, they are taking some big risks with constituencies that are far-ranging. And I don't know how this will play out. Brad Wilson and other leaders said that they are committed to do this. They did say that they will come out of the session with something. Huh. So I think that this was just released. This package was just released yesterday. So I think what we're seeing is sort of the starting point, and we may see some changes in that.
Changes, one that you could imagine happening is that a number of groups would lobby to be, you know, to get an exemption.
Absolutely.
From this. And so if you give one to, you know, say the building, the development community, what's to stop, you know, another group of lobbyists coming forward and saying, hey, if you're doing that, you've got to exempt, newspapers. Newspapers actually surprises me, Dan, that newspapers falls into this because a lot of states have said, hey, we're gonna keep sales tax exemptions on newspapers because of what it is. But I have no idea. Are you guys gonna lobby against it?
I don't know. That's above my pay grade.
Okay. Well, it's interesting to see, and it will be interesting to see what happens. What will it mean for for residents of Utah? Is it going to increase the cost of things?
So, in doing this, what they're saying is they're going to add all of these new taxable items and they're going to offset that by lowering the rate for everybody. So the sales tax you pay on that you would expect to pay on normal items, clothing and cars and other things that are subject to the sales tax will be reduced. You will pay less in taxes for those. Now they've talked about rates right now, how much they want to drop in and how much those taxes will be cut. I don't like to focus on that too much because I think that's very fungible right now. I think that's subject to a lot of change. But the idea is that they're going to tax all these new things, but they're not going to take a windfall because they're going to reduce rates on everything to kind of account for that.
Okay. Well, we'll see what kind of changes are made to this as it makes its way through, as the proposal, I guess, is unveiled to the full legislature.
Yeah. One, I think, that's already being worked over pretty good and probably will see change is a proposal in the original plan that would put a tax on health insurance premiums. So that one is already being worked on, and we may see changes to that.
FACE is probably a big lobby as well.
Yes.
We need to take another break on the show. There's still a little bit more to come. We'll talk about plastic bags and what's happening with alcohol policy at the state legislative session. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
A few 2 years ago, composer Osvaldo Golijov was in Israel and saw the effects of a wave of violence. Shortly after that, he was serenely observing our entire planet in a planetarium show. Music inspired by contrasting perspectives on the next Performance Today from APM.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
The U.S. isn't the only country with a raging immigration debate. Europe has its own. But maybe the solution isn't stronger borders. Maybe it's no borders.
We live in a time when we can communicate with anyone in the world, anywhere, regardless of borders. And yet, our identities are chained more than ever to borders.
That's next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry and Jessica Miller. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments. 801-355-8255 is the number to call, or you can tweet us at KCPW. Dan, we were talking about taxes and the legislative session before the break, kind of a wild change of topics here, but plastic bags. I think it was last year or the year before, I can't remember which, that we saw a similar measure, which is to prevent cities from banning plastic bags. What's happening this year, Dan?
Yeah, we call it the bag ban ban.
Bag ban ban.
Right. Because you're banning bag bans.
Right. Okay, it's super complicated, but yeah.
So, yeah, there's pushback on this. I believe that the towns, the cities of Park City and Moab have put this ban in place. And the idea is, as you know, plastic bags are a real nuisance and environmental threat. The environmentalists have talked about, finding wildlife that had plastic bags in their throat and suffocated them, and they do not disintegrate. And as you know, too, if you recycle at home, the recyclers are saying, don't put your plastic bags in there because we won't take them. Mm-hmm. We will just take them out and send them to the landfill where they will sit for, hundreds of years. And by the time they disintegrate, probably depleted uranium will be very radioactive in the States.
We can get to that story in a second, too. But why would Utah lawmakers care if a city wants to ban plastic? I mean, like you said, there's this pollution problem. Municipalities are trying to do something about that. What's the argument for stopping municipalities from doing that?
Well, I'll tell you what my theory is. My theory is that the Retailers Association, which is a very powerful lobby in the state, does not want to see this spread beyond where it is because they like plastic bags. I think they're cheaper than paper. I think they're easier to handle, and they're probably more convenient for the grocery store. So I think that's a large part of what's happening. Some people just see this as a total anti-environment move, and I don't think it's as clear as that. I do think it's because there's an interested lobby here that has its own reasons for not wanting this done. The official reason given is we need to have a statewide policy on this. We shouldn't do a patchwork quilt of policies, and that's oftentimes what the legislature says when there are other reasons they don't want to use officially. So
consistency.
That's the reason why gun laws in the state are all controlled by the state legislature. They've instituted state law that says local governments, you do not have control over firearms, ownership, possession, and whatnot. The only thing left to local jurisdictions on firearms is outlawing the discharge of them within city limits.
The bag ban, how far has it gotten in the legislature?
It's passed committee now. It's on the House floor waiting for action there. As you said, this has been up before, and so we'll see if it happens. The last time it was up, interestingly, they had a opposite bill. The bill was to allow cities or to put a tax on plastic bags. And the idea being that if you have to pay a tax on them, you're going to be more likely to bring your own reusable bags. And that got shot down. So I don't think we've seen that bill introduced this session, but we have seen the bag ban.
Well, let's turn, Dan, you know, one thing that we might be carrying in those plastic bags or whatever the bag is made out of is beer. Let's turn now to what's happening with a measure to increase the alcohol content in grocery store bought beer. Any updates on whether that beer might have more alcohol than the currently allowed 3.2% swill we can currently buy, Dan?
Well, very interesting. You know, Utah's been known for that 3.2 beer for a long time, not in a good way. But when the LDS Church came out against allowing stronger beers in grocery stores, a lot of people, you know, that have been observers of the legislature for many years said, this thing's dead. And then surprisingly, the Senate has passed it. And yesterday, Governor Herbert came out and endorsed it. So if that seems to be a lot of momentum for it, if it can get out of the House, it's going to be state law that will allow, you know, I think 4.8 beer to be sold in grocery stores. Once again, the retailers, very powerful lobby in the state. If they are not allowed to have stronger beer in the grocery stores, they are going to take a big, big hit because a lot of the major breweries, national breweries, Anheuser-Busch and others, are going to stop making 3.2 beer. And, of course, when you have less selection of beer, you have less beer in stock, you're going to sell less beer, and that's a huge hit to retailers.
Well, I was going to say that it might drive people to the state liquor stores, which would maybe increase, you know, revenues for the state. Maybe I don't know.
I mean, if you've ever been in a state liquor store, yes, they do sell stronger beer than the 4.8 too, but the selection's not that great, and trying to find a parking place is is horrendous. And lines can be long, and it's sold warm. It's not allowed to be sold chilled.
Because you might drink it right there.
No, you might yeah, right there in the park of the crowded parking lot. And
we have to turn to one more story before we end the show. But this is advancing despite the fact that it has opposition from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which
is pretty surprising. The governor's endorsed it. The Senate passed it.
Just before we finish, I want to turn to a bill that would allow the storage of depleted uranium in the state. That has now passed through both bodies. It's gone through the House and Senate. And if I'm not mistaken, is now just awaiting the governor's signature. But there are people pressuring Governor Herbert to veto that bill. Can you talk about that, Dan?
Yeah, and the governor talked about this yesterday at his press news conference. He didn't say outright that he was going to sign it, but he gave every indication that he is going to sign it. One of the questions that was asked of him was, doesn't it concern you that the company Energy Solutions is spreading all of this money among legislators? It donated to 38 legislators, and 36 of those legislators voted for its legislation. Similar result last year when it got a $1.7 million fee break from legislators. Almost all of the ones who received money from the company voted for the company's bill. And this is the company's bill. I mean, it's had some amendments, but very interesting when it came to the committee, the sponsoring lawmaker gave a brief introduction and then turned over all of the comments and questions to Energy Solutions lobbyists. That tells you whose bill it is. But yeah, the governor, who doesn't take money from Energy Solutions, continuing the policy of his predecessor, John Huntsman, said he doesn't worry about the contributions. He doesn't think that's an issue. He's going to judge on its merits, and I think he's going to sign the bill.
Okay. I mean, he is getting probably a fair amount of calls. An article in the Tribune talked about the environmental groups that are reaching out to the governor's office to try and encourage him to veto it. But he says in his news conference, or he seems to appear seems to appear. He appears to be ready to sign the bill.
I think the pen is probably in his hand just inches above that bill
right now.
Right
as we're
now.
Speaking. Okay. It is time. We need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, the final segment of the show where we highlight a story we didn't talk about today. Jessica Miller, do you want to kick us off with an underplayed story?
Yeah. So I went to San Pete County earlier this week for a sentencing for a juvenile who he admitted to sexually assaulting basically several of his classmates, eight of them. Well, actually, there's more like a dozen who had said that basically that he sexually assaulted them. And it was so fascinating because there were so many victims in this small area, and it really just has split that community in two. There's, you know, half the people who think that this wasn't sexual assault, that this was just horseplay or like hazing. It was kind of like very, very extreme hazing. And then there's, you know, the other half of this community whose children have been assaulted who, you know, said this wasn't fun and games. This isn't boys being boys. This was sexual assault. And so to hear these, you know, young teenage boys talking about the trauma they've experienced from the situation, how they've been bullied as long as they could remember by this youth. I mean, it was a heartbreaking story.
It's a pretty remarkable story. It takes place in Gunnison. Mm-hmm. As I recall, there's one, you know, witness who coming forward, who actually reporting what had happened to him was sort of the beginning of this, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there was one student who was assaulted on the football field, and he told the school resource officer about it. And from there, it was like these floodgates just opened. And there were several of these boys that the victims who tested or who spoke at this hearing who said, you know, had it not been for that kid, you know, I would never have said anything. You know, one kid said that, you know, he was just happy that there was someone who was braver than him to say something and gave him the courage to say something as well. So it was something that had been going on at this school. It's a really small area, very small school. So this had been going on for such a long time. All the students really knew about it, but it took that one kid kind of standing up and saying that this was abuse to kind of open up the floodgates.
Yeah. Kind of seems like that's always how it happens, right? Mm-hmm. One courageous person comes forward. We saw that in the BYU sexual assault cases.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Dan Harry, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I am going to pick a story from the legislature, and it is that we've seen lawmakers in the first few weeks of the session repeal and replace two initiatives that were approved by voters, the medical marijuana and the Medicaid expansion, and they have basically decided that voters didn't know exactly what they were voting on, and so legislators came in and put their own versions in place instead. Now they are considering legislation that would delay the implementation of any voter-approved initiative until after the next legislative session to make sure they had plenty of time to do this to any initiatives in the future. Seems like they had plenty of time to change the ones that passed this last year. So I'm not sure they need all that extra time. But I think by doing that legislation, they're making clear they intend to do this again in the future.
All right. Dan Harry's pick, some changes to how initiatives are passed in the state of Utah. I'm going to forego my pick for underplayed story, although check it out. It's about the NAACP celebrating 100 years in the state of Utah. Great reporting there at sltrib.com. Dan Harry and Jessica Miller with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you,
Thank
Roger.
You.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Join us again next week and find podcasts at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Apogee Instruments, a Cache Valley company building precision sensors that support global research in sustainable food production, renewable energy, and climate change.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan, and UPR.org.